U.S. House prosecutors wrap up their impeachment case against former President Donald Trump, urging the Senate to convict him of inciting the January 6th attack on the Capitol. The European Parliament calls on the bloc's member states to ban arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE over their violation of human rights in Yemen. Also ahead, Israel is reportedly planning to build a neighborhood including about 250 units for settlers in central occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, Donald Trump's impeachment prosecutors say the former president should not be allowed to ever hold the top office again.
Dear colleagues, is there any political leader in this room who believes that if he is ever allowed by the Senate to get back into the Oval Office, Donald Trump would stop inciting violence to get his way? Would you bet the lives of more police officers on that? Would you bet the safety of your family on that? Would you bet the future of your democracy on that? President Trump declared his conduct totally appropriate. So, if he gets back into office and it happens again, we'll have no one to blame but ourselves.
The Democratic representative was addressing the Senate during the third day of the impeachment trial for inciting the deadly attack on the Capitol building. Raskin said the assault did not spring into life out of thin air and was in line with the former president's continuing pattern and practice of inciting violence. Representative Ted Lieu also argued that the former president's lack of remorse since the riot shows he intended the events of January the 6th to happen and that such violence could occur again in the future. Earlier, President Joe Biden said the harrowing video evidence of the assault may change some minds.
Send a message that is.
I think the Senate has a very important job to complete, and I think my guess is some minds may have been changed, but I don't know.
Biden was referring to the videos that were presented by the House impeachment managers during the second day of the trial. The footage shed new light on the extent of the attack as it showed how a mob left a pro-Trump rally and invaded the Capitol building. Trump supporters were seeking to stop the certification of Biden's November 3rd election victory. The mayhem left five people, including a police officer, dead. The Democratic impeachment managers wrapped up their case. A conviction requires a two-thirds majority in the Senate. If convicted, the Senate could hold a second vote to disqualify the one-term president from seeking office again. White Reed says the Democrats' likely failure to convict Trump has given rise to speculation that the impeachment trial is mere political posturing.
Tomorrow, starting at noon Eastern Time, will be the turn of the lawyers for the Trump defense to take their swing at it. They will have up to 16 hours to present their side of the story, although whether they even want to use that the entirety of that time remains to be seen. Their presentation of this impeachment trial is that it's kind of a waste of time, so you know it may work out for their logic to sort of you know not even use the sheer amount of time that they have. I think their argument is going to be pretty simple. Donald Trump is no longer president. The argument that we heard from Democrats today, specifically from Jonah Goose, Democratic representative from Colorado, they're focused on three main points. Was violence foreseeable? Did Trump encourage violence? And did Trump act willfully? They say the answer to all three of those questions is yes. They still seem to be 11 senators short of that two-thirds majority, which they would need to convict Donald Trump. Again, leading a lot of observers to speculate that this is kabuki theater.
The Yemeni army says it has launched a ballistic missile targeting King Khalid Air Base in the southwest of Saudi Arabia. Yemen's army spokesman Yahya Sari' said the missile has successfully hit the airbase located near the city of Khamis Mushayyit in Asir province. He added that the strike was in response to a recent surge in Saudi-led coalition's attacks against Yemen. Sari' said the missile was a new type that was used for the first time. This is the latest in a series of retaliatory strikes by the Yemeni army against Saudi positions in reaction to the kingdom's war on the country. Sana'a says its retaliatory attacks will continue until Riyadh stops its devastating strikes, which have killed tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians since March 2015. The European Parliament has called for a European Union-wide ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and its allies who are attacking Yemen. In a joint motion, the bloc's member states were urged to place an embargo on the export, sale, update and maintenance of any form of security equipment to the Saudi-led coalition. The motion cited serious breaches of international humanitarian and human rights law committed by the coalition in Yemen. The European Parliament also called for EU sanctions against the human rights violators in the Arab country. The motion welcomed Germany's arms sale ban to Saudi Arabia and Italy's ban to the UAE and Riyadh. Ken Stone is from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War and joins us now. Ken, welcome. Yeah, what's your reaction to this call by the European Parliament? It's for nearly 6 years now. Human rights groups and others have been warning about Saudi violations in Yemen.
Well, this is welcome news indeed. And we can only hope that the United Kingdom and Canada soon follow suit. I want to point out once again that in Canada, Justin Trudeau ran first for Parliament in 2015 and promised that he would end the Canadian arms sales to Saudi Arabia. But once in power, he reversed himself, and despite massive Canadian opposition to these sales, he expanded the sales. A couple of weeks ago, on January 25th, Canadians joined the global mobilization against the war in Yemen and told Trudeau that we want him to stop these sales of arms to Saudi Arabia. Now, this step taken by the EU is a step in the right direction. But we hope that it will go beyond mere words soon. And now that the Biden administration has indicated that it's opposed to offensive Saudi operations against Yemen, perhaps the countries of the world can take collective action through the United Nations to put sanctions on the countries of the Saudi coalition and force them to stop the war against the people of Yemen. The people of Yemen have a right to self-determination over their sovereign territory, and the EU and other countries of the world need to use their muscle to actually put sanctions and put teeth into the resolutions to stop this horrible war against the poorest country in the Arab world.
Right, and Ken, just before I let you go, with all these calls to ban arms sales to Saudi Arabia and its allies, does it remind everyone who the aggressor is here and who is defending their sovereignty?
Well, the Houthi people of Yemen rose up against a Saudi-imposed government in 2014, I think it was, and the war started in 2015. It's been going on for 6 years. And you know, what people around the world have to remember is that the people of Yemen are sovereign. They have the right to self-determination. They have the right to resist the Saudi aggression and the Saudi occupation. And now that we're talking about ending arms sales and bringing an end to this war, it's also time perhaps for people around the world and countries around the world that have been involved in this horrible war, which created the world's worst humanitarian crisis, to start thinking about paying reparations in order that the Yemeni people can rebuild their country.
Ken, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Ken Stone there from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Now, Israel is reportedly planning to build new settlement units in the occupied West Bank. An Israeli newspaper said the new units will be built in occupied central Jerusalem al-Quds. According to the report, the plan includes the construction of several 24-story buildings, 250 protected units, and hundreds of offices and other facilities. Earlier this week, reports said Israeli authorities were planning to expand the settlements in Jerusalem al-Quds by 900 new units. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Iran's foreign minister has called on the U.S. to comply with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal before asking Iran to do so. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said Washington withdrew from the international accord in 2018 and punished the countries that were complying with the United Nations resolution that endorsed the deal. He added that President Joe Biden's administration is still in the same position, but keeps talking about Iran's compliance with the nuclear agreement. His comments come amid a standoff between Tehran and Washington, with each asking the other to act first to salvage the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Political commentator E. Michael Jones says the goal of the United States has always been to destroy Iran, whether Democrats or Republicans are in power.
The goal has always been to destroy Iran, one way or the other. And I think the Democrats had an idea that if over the long haul, we could simply subvert the entire country with things like the color revolution of 2009, the failed color revolution of 2009. If they could gain time and they could gain access, I think they felt that they could bring about the fall of the revolutionary government. Now, what has happened here is we have 4 years now of a man who came to power, Donald Trump, by telling us he was going to withdraw from the Middle East, never really accomplished that. And in a contradiction to that policy, which was the America First policy, he tightened the screws on Iran and overturned the JCPOA. So the question is, what has happened in this 4 years? What has happened to the Democrats? And it seems to me it should be obvious that when Biden got in, he should overthrow all of Trump's policies. But apparently there's hesitation now. So whether the Democrats have now gone over to the hard line, the Likudnik hard line, is something that we have to anticipate here. Maybe this is the change that's taken place over these 4 years.
Massive inflation and unprecedented price hike has triggered violent protests in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Javed Rana reports from Islamabad.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300% inflation rate has been high and increased during the previous 2.5 years. And we are still, the PTI government has not increased even 1% our salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence in government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Elsewhere, China has banned the broadcast of BBC World News, accusing it of giving fake and biased reports. A government statement said the BBC's China-related reports seriously violated broadcast guidelines and had harmed China's national interests. That came a week after a British regulator banned the Chinese broadcaster CGTN over license problems. The ban has provoked UK's condemnation, with the country's Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab calling the move an unacceptable curtailing of media freedom. Beijing and London are at odds over several issues, including Britain's ban on Chinese telecom group Huawei and the situation in Hong Kong. Ukraine is pressing the European Union to impose tougher sanctions on Russia over alleged human rights abuses. Some EU lawmakers, however, say the EU doesn't want to start a new Cold War with Russia. Jerome Hughes has the details.
The seventh so-called Ukraine Association Council meeting has just taken place in Brussels. The delegation that travelled from Kiev used the opportunity to encourage the EU to ramp up its sanctions against Moscow.
We hope that the deep sanctions regime for violations of human rights would allow for the enhancement of the sanctions list and the expansion of the sanctions list of the European Union.
Russia denies claims it is trying to destabilize Ukraine and asserts its right to protect what it sees as legitimate regional interests. Just like several other nations surrounding Russia, the EU would like Ukraine to join its 27-nation bloc.
The European Union has already provided significant overall financial assistance to Ukraine. We are talking about 16 billion euros since 2014.
The EU regularly reminds us of its values, but critics say the bloc is often willing to look the other way in pursuit of its ambitions to further expand and to isolate Russia. After all, Ukraine is consistently ranked one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The EU needs Russia. The European Commission's own website says two-thirds of the EU's oil imports come from Russia, as do three-quarters of its gas imports. A new pipeline from Russia to Germany, which is 90% complete, is set to double the EU's gas imports. We don't need a new Cold War, many argue.
As a Russian speaker living in the European Union, and not me only, but 6 million we are all over, we want good relations, we don't want war.
Earlier this week, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell attracted scathing criticism in the European Parliament.
High Representative Borrell, you should resign.
This was for going ahead with an official visit to Moscow last week. However, some legislators expressed an alternative view.
This isn't about human rights. This is a geopolitical agenda against Russia, fueled by a military-industrial complex who need an enemy to justify their millions.
If that is true, as citizens, most of us clearly underestimate the power of the arms industry. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That report brings an end to our bulletin for this hour.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. The crushing decline of oil industry during the COVID-19 pandemic may be unprecedented, but is also a foreseeable outcome for fossil fuel producers in the years ahead. The race to create clean-burning biofuels and hydrogen to propel aircraft and seaborne tankers is gaining pace. At the same time, electric vehicles are accelerating into the mainstream. A green transport future is arriving faster than even the most optimistic of environmentalists had hoped and fossil fuel executives had feared. The article you're about to hear has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, "Massive Losses Should Be a Warning to Big Oil That Its Bonanza Is Over." Please stay with us for more of The Guardian's article. According to BP's chief executive, the final months of 2020 were a tough end to a tough year. But Bernard Looney's verdict on the worst financial year in the industry's history is a devastating understatement. It was a period marked by thousands of job cuts, battered dividend policies, and record multi-billion-dollar losses. British Petroleum, BP, revealed a full-year loss of $18 billion, its first since the Deepwater Horizon disaster more than a decade ago. Whilst US oil giant ExxonMobil reported an annual loss of $22.4 billion, its first ever loss. Shell capped a year in which it slashed its dividends for the first time since the Second World War, with a debit of almost $20 billion. The crushing decline of the oil industry during the COVID-19 pandemic may be unprecedented, but is also a foreseeable outcome for fossil fuel producers in the years ahead. The race to create clean-burning biofuels and hydrogen to propel aircraft and seaborne tankers is gaining pace. At the same time, electric vehicles are accelerating into the mainstream. A green transport future is arriving faster than even the most optimistic of environmentalists had ever hoped, and fossil fuel executives had feared. Managers have a choice now. They can view the 2020 collapse as an unprecedented event in the history of the industry, or a grim foreshadowing of its value in a world that no longer needs fossil fuels. Of course, both are valid viewpoints. But unless oil companies prepare today for a greener future, they face an indefinite number of dire financial years ahead. There are some signs that the warning of 2020 has been heeded by the world's biggest producers, companies including British Petroleum BP, Shell, and Norway's oil giant Equinor, are taking an aggressive position within the offshore wind market. Shell is accelerating its move into electric vehicle charging, and all seems enamored by the potential for a hydrogen economy. But the real trick to guarding against the risky future for fossil fuel production is to stop producing fossil fuels. None of the major oil companies seems ready to make that leap. They may want to hurry. For further proof, if it were needed, that the low-carbon race is advancing apace, turn your attention to the US comedy star Will Ferrell. The actor has temporarily traded in his big-screen gags for a General Motors television advert in which he vows to help the US beat Norway's dominance in electric vehicles. The advertisement, which is due to run in the US during the Super Bowl, is perhaps the clearest sign that foregoing fossil fuel is no longer the niche pursuit of the eco-conscious. If the star of Anchorman is using the phrase, "Norway's out EVing us," is one of the most watched US television slots of the year, we can safely assume that electric vehicles have arrived in the hearts and minds of Middle America. There will be big oil naysayers who insist that the road towards green transport will be more of a long and winding path than a motorway. That is to be expected. It comes from the same playbook used by the fossil fuel industry when renewable energy began to emerge. Energy from the sun and the wind was once dismissed as being too expensive, too difficult to store, and technically incapable of playing a major role in the energy system. But in a matter of years, renewable energy developers have quietly proved these theories wrong. Oil company bosses who believe there is one last hurrah for fossil fuels before the green renaissance takes hold may be proved wrong yet again, and this time there will be no excuses. Many warning shots have been fired in the green revolution, but none so loudly as in 2020. It's time to bite the bullet. Since the United Kingdom mass vaccination program began, the value of sterling has crept steadily higher against the euro. From a low of 1.09 euro on 11th of December, the pound has risen to edge above 1.14 euro. If the relative value of currencies is any guide to the future, it seems clear investors are betting on the United Kingdom having a purported brighter 2021 than the eurozone. The European Central Bank is likely to confirm this outlook when it meets next month by downgrading the outlook for economic growth this year for the 19-member currency bloc from around 4% to nearer 3%. It will blame the delays in vaccination procurement for holding back what was at one stage predicted to be a robust economic recovery. Meanwhile, the Bank of England says a strong bounce back beckons in the second half of the year, resulting in 5% economic growth overall in 2021. But while a faster vaccination program is significant, it is not the only issue affecting economic growth. When the figures are tallied, the United Kingdom will almost certainly have suffered a 10% contraction in 2020, much worse than the Eurozone average of 6.8%. This means Britain starts 2021 from a weaker position than its European neighbours. Government spending, and not just on healthcare, also matters. At the moment, the Conservative Party is heading towards setting a budget in March that will be dominated by talk of bringing down the public spending deficit as much as ways we supposedly boost the economy. The European Union has no such concerns when much of its 750 billion euro stimulus package has yet to be spent, and its manufacturing base is motoring along, whilst the UK suffers an overload of Brexit trade bureaucracy. That means there are plenty of strip hazards ahead for both British and European Union forecasters. Their predictions may be modified many times before the year is out. As oil revenues plunge, the drilling giants are getting set for a switch to renewable energies. An auction of seabed plots for wind farms off the coast of England and Wales has attracted record bids as new companies pile into the sector, with predictions that it will raise more than £4 billion in licensing fees over the next decade. With Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson calling for every home in the United Kingdom to be powered by renewable energy by 2030, the seabed looks set to remain a major source of revenue for the British state. So the time has come for a debate on what the nation should do with this green windfall. As things stand, a quarter of the cash will go to the Queen. The other three quarters will flow to to the treasury. A first step would be to reduce the monarch's share of revenues from the Crown State, which manages all her property, including her rights to the seabed. At present, she's entitled to 25% of Crown State income. The sum was increased from 15% in 2017 in order to help pay for repairs to Buckingham Palace. That decision should now be reversed. Even a smaller share will be more than enough to pay for the rewiring. The bigger question is how the Treasury should manage its portion of the windfall. Some, including the Green Party, want the money invested for future generations. Norway's sovereign wealth fund is a source of envy around the world, perhaps nowhere more so than in Britain. One of the largest state-owned nest eggs in the world, the Oil Fund, or Oljefondet in Norwegian, was created in 1990 from North Sea oil revenues and is now worth more than £700 billion. The investment income is helping to pay for the coronavirus pandemic. Margaret Thatcher's government spent the takings from Britain's 1980s oil boom by recycling them into cuts in taxes and welfare benefits. Had the money been put into a fund, the Institute for Public Policy Research calculated a couple of years ago, it would be worth some £500 billion today. The United Kingdom must make the most of this new opportunity.
Food for thought.
Hello dear friends, and today, a day after the 42nd anniversary of the glorious victory of the Islamic Revolution, led by the sage of the age, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, we present you a wonderful saying to ponder upon from the Holy Prophet's 11th infallible heir, Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him, concerning the duties of the faithful during the long period of occultation of the 12th Imam. Follow the qualified jurist who refrains from committing wrong, emphasizes his faith, opposes carnal desires, and obeys Allah's command.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
شما در این قرن معجزه کردید.
ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. Of course, this program is dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, and it's about his life and times and his great personality. I'm your host for this program, Ijaz Hussain, and I'd first like to welcome my guest who on the program who is going to discuss this great personality with me. And that's Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, my good friend, and I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. He's an Islamic scholar as well as an academic and a researcher as well. I think we're going to begin from, you know, our continuation, because this is like part two of what we were saying in our previous program, which was about the Bakhtiar government and about the fact that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, was like a lion. Right? In terms of, you know, you talked about the throffer that was given by the American government at the time.
Threat and offer.
Threat and offer. And, you know, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, comes out with the fatwa for a jihad against the U.S., which was something that, you know, they hadn't come across. They were completely...
No, it was, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, basically, and this goes back to, you know, we mentioned in the previous program that the Supreme Leader recently was talking about Imam.
Sure.
And we had the quote. I don't know if you want, maybe we can.
Yeah, let's have that quote again. You know, if we could have that quote, please, from the Supreme Leader, and then we'll carry on with our discussion here.
کسی مثل امام بزرگوار ما که یک تنه وارد شد.
Somebody like our magnanimous Imam, who single-handedly entered the arena, managed to unite all the people and launch this great movement with his firm determination, faith, and reliance on God, relied more than anything else on knowledge and understanding, on worship of God, and on the enthusiasm which originates from one's heart and soul. Until the end of his life, this great person used to wake up in the middle of the night and shed tears despite being old and physically weak.
با وجود پیری و ناتوانی و شکستگی نیمه شب بر می‌خواست اشک می‌ریخت. ما خبر داشتیم از نزدیکان ایشان که به
We knew it because we had heard from his close relatives, who knew everything about his lifestyle, that he used to wake up in the middle of the night and ask Allah, the Exalted, for help. He used to keep a vigil at night. He was like this at night, and during the day, he used to enter the arena like a roaring lion and defeat global powers and solve the people's problems. He used to strengthen and set in motion the determination of all the people, thanks to his reliance on spirituality.
Yes,
I mean, as I say, it was a very, very powerful speech there by the Supreme Leader about Imam Khomeini. But carry on with your point
so
from the last...
We talked about the fact that, you know, at the time, you basically had the Shah left.
That's right.
And he had appointed a government led by Shapur Bakhtiar as the government. Imam, from the beginning, refused to acknowledge the legality of this government, which, you know, we're talking about the fact that Imam was a person who combined spirituality, but also was very courageous and also led people.
Yes.
And this being something very new, or he revived this
revived it.
This divine tradition, this prophetic tradition.
Prophetic tradition.
Which had been lost, you know, with the
over
separation.
The centuries, unfortunately. Yes.
And having to do with the weaknesses of Christianity itself.
Yes.
This is why it was abandoned in Western civilization, because Christianity itself was, you know, changed in such a way that it no longer
became relevant.
Exactly. Mm. So at that time, they said to Imam, I'm just quickly repeating what we spoke about in the previous program and then continuing in our analysis of this. Mm-hmm. They said to Imam at that time, well, you got what you wanted. The Shah has left. You know, it's done.
That's right.
Good job.
Good job. Go
Thank
back
you.
To the mosque.
Okay. Right. And so basically, they sent a message to him through one of these people that was connected to both sides, saying that, you know, if you don't accept the Bakhtiar government, we will tell the Americans.
The Americans sent this message to Imam,
if you don't accept the Bakhtiar government, we will tell the army, which at that time the Americans had influence on, because a lot of the officers were American trained.
Sure.
We will tell the army to conduct a coup d'etat and arrest all of you and execute all of you. So what would be the usual response? Because remember, we quoted Henry Kissinger saying that Imam would make decisions that were, you know, earth-shaking. We didn't know how to deal with it. We didn't know what to do. He would do things that were completely different than everybody else.
Absolutely.
And again, Henry Kissinger saying that, you know, this was because his view was based on divine teachings, on divine teachings and precepts, and thus we didn't know what to do with all this. And, you know, you talked about the fact that, you know, other administration members at that time, U.S. administration, said that, you know, when in the meetings of experts,
Secretary of State George Shultz
would come up with, you know, what should we do about the Ayatollah Khomeini, and everybody would just look at each other, you know, we don't know what to
do. Yeah, well, Shultz being of a German descent anyway, you know, and that's saying something.
Well, Henry is German.
Well, he is German.
Right, exactly.
Sorry.
Right. So,
I stand corrected.
Right. Yeah. So the point is that Imam, in response to this threat by the Americans, says, if you do this, I will. He didn't issue the fatwa of jihad. He said, I will issue a fatwa of jihad, and we will fight and take over the country ourselves. So, you know, remember, this is in the context where the Americans, where Mr. Kissinger himself recently had overthrown Allende in Chile. What's the guy's name? Pinochet, and killed all the opposition. Yeah, sure. You had the same thing happening, Suharto in Indonesia, killing 500,000 Communist Party members, in Indonesia, or, you know, people related to it.
Sure.
You had this happening around the world by the Americans. What I mean with this happening is the military connected to the U.S. Conducting coup d'etats and killing the opposition to the Americans in the country.
Sure.
Okay, so this was not some empty threat.
There was not an empty threat.
This was not something, you know, people had seen this.
Well, I mean, I was going to also say that, you know, we're talking about the aftermath of even the Vietnam War, because even the Vietnam War was fairly recent up until the time of the Islamic Revolution. So let's not forget that there was a hell of a lot of war crimes and barbarity shown in Vietnam. And with, you know, the B-52 bomber, with all that, you know, those famous photographs that we see in Apocalypse Now, you know, they show the bombs all coming down, raining bombs all over Vietnam. So you're right, you know, it's not on the back of an empty threat. This is real. I mean, this is something
and
that
a lesser
they could have devastated Iran.
And a lesser man would have folded.
Exactly. A lesser man would have folded.
This is the point. Okay, this person who was the connection, which we mentioned in the previous program, he was a member of the religious national movement in Iran, who had lived in the States for many years, has spent his exile time in the States. He told the story on the BBC. We are quoting his story as he has explained it, so nobody thinks that we're making up stories.
No, we're not making up stuff. This is all archived.
Right. So he when he's telling this story on the BBC, you could tell he didn't understand. He was frustrated. He's like, why would Imam like tell them this? Why didn't he just accept it and go to Qom and, you know? And this is a religious person.
Yes.
Remember, this is not somebody, you know, who's, you know, whatever.
There are religious people in inverted commas and religious people.
So the point is, as you said, it's, you know, you having this deep belief. It's
deep
not only
belief.
About reading the Quran. It's not only about, you know, it's about
because you
belief.
Mentioned this word faith, didn't you? You
right.
mentioned
it's
this
faith.
About
it's
it.
Not just knowing things. You have to believe in it.
Yeah,
when the Quran says that you can stand up to the biggest oppressors and be successful, you have to believe it.
You have to believe it.
It's good to read it. It's good to say, well, you know, give it. You're doing a speech. You're doing a radio program. Blah blah blah. You know, and the Quran says, but you don't really believe it in your life. You know, if you don't translate that in your life, you know, what's the point? So this is the beauty of Imam, is that he had complete trust in Allah, had complete trust in the word of Allah.
Yeah, we could see that.
And he lived it. And when he was challenged, and when he was tested by Allah, and when Shaitan tried to, you know, threaten him with what is it, with poverty and corruption,
kinds of things, corruption
right? He
was,
stood up and he, you know, said, this is the deal.
Yeah.
So he This is the first part.
As the first part, that's right. That's
so then he comes to Iran. Bakhtiar government is still there.
Still there.
He
yes,
enters the famous film of him coming with the plane.
Cemetery, yes.
And he goes directly from the airport. Yeah. He goes to Besht Sahara, which
throughout
is the
adulation of millions welcoming him at Mehrabad.
Right.
Airport,
and throughout the way on the road, as we've seen in the films.
Sure.
He goes straight to Besht Sahara, which is the main cemetery in Tehran.
Big iconic images. Yes.
Right. And he goes to the area where many of the shuhada of the revolution and the fight
martyrs,
against
at Behesht Yazara,
against the regime of the Shah are buried, and he holds a speech there.
That's correct, yes.
And here, remember, this is with the threat that he's gotten.
Yes, already.
Okay, there's rumors, and everybody's scared that, you know, they're going to shoot down his plane. Mm. And they say to him, well, what if... He goes, takes a nap during the flight.
Yes, he does.
You know, they're like, everybody's like on tenderhooks.
Yeah,
like,
they're all sort of like,
we're going to get shut down.
A SAM battery opening up any moment.
Right,
yeah.
And he goes and takes a nap, okay? Because he gets off the plane, you know, you have this in this typical Eastern, you know, emotionalism saying, oh, what do you feel?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
right,
about entering. He goes,
John Simpson asked him that.
You know, he goes, nothing. No, it was an Iranian.
Was it? It was an Iranian.
It was also an Iranian. He says, what do you feel? And he says the famous heech.
Heech, yes.
Nothing. What do you feel? Nothing.
That's right.
And they misunderstood. Right. When he meant heech, it meant that, you know, this people coming and, you know, this is not the issue.
This is not the issue. This is not
this
the
is
point.
Not the
that's,
issue. The fact
that's the
that,
most important
you know,
point,
it's not that I don't feel anything.
No,
it's the fact that this is not the point.
Point.
That, you know, I'm coming or there's going to be, you know. No. The point is, you know, the people and having justice and establishing justice.
That's right.
So he goes to the, he goes to Besht Sahara.
Yes.
He has that famous speech, which, you know, just thinking about it, I'm just, you know, you just get emotional because the speech starts with the children. There's a children's choir and they're singing this very famous song, which is in Iran, is famous, talking about the martyrs and... Well, anyways, I mean, this was it's a very moving and emotional thing. And then he starts talking and he says, you know, this is, you remember, 80-year-old Grand Ayatollah?
Exactly.
He says, we will punch this government in the mouth.
That's right.
We will establish our own government.
من دولت تعیین میکنم. من تو دهن این دولت میزنم.
من دولت تعیین میکنم. من به پشتیبانی این ملت دولت تعیین میکنم. من به واسطه این که ملت مرا قبول دارد
Okay, so remember, all of this in the context of coup d'etat, you know, killing, executions, this is all
That's
being
right.
threatened.
That's right.
So he goes and he stays in Qom at first. And what does the Bakhtiar government do? They issue martial law. They proclaim martial law.
That's true.
Which is what all
of course.
Oppressors do,
do
at some point.
At some point, yes.
Which is that people are not allowed to be in the streets after 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
I see.
This was the martial law.
Okay.
And anybody there without permission
will be shot. Yes.
Remember, will be shot.
Shot. And this comes in the background, of course.
And people lost lives because of this. They had to go to the hospital. They couldn't go to the hospital.
Exactly.
People, you know, needing medication. Could.
Sure.
So this is, it's real.
Because
it's not,
I wanted to put it in the context.
This, because during the time of the Shah, the Shah would
do
this.
Yeah, that's right. This is what I wanted to mention.
You know,
in 1963, for example.
Right.
Yeah,
so this was not something, you know, people knew what this
meant. People knew what this meant. Okay. This is serious.
Serious stuff. Mm. So what does Imam do? They say to him, well, it's martial law. What does Imam do? What does Imam say? Mm-hmm. Again, roaring lion.
Roaring lion.
Courage.
Back to that. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
He says, tell the people to go out.
Out. And knowing full well what the consequences
well,
are.
Well, people around him. I'm talking about people around him.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
even, you know,
yeah.
religious people, you know, revolutionaries.
Yeah.
They fold it. They said, well, what if the people get killed?
Killed.
You know, the blood will be on your hands.
Hands.
This, you know, these kind of,
you know,
threats and these kind of, you know, of underhanded.
Yes.
As though Imam doesn't know.
Doesn't know.
Right. So Imam's very calmly just says, tell the people to go out.
Oh.
And they went out, and that's it. That's when the revolution was successful.
Successful, yes.
Because the enemies, internally and externally, saw that there's nothing they can do.
Do.
No threat is going to scare this man. Okay?
Excellent.
And it's at that time when you see that within a couple of weeks, within a short period of time, the Bakhtiar government falls.
Falls, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they talked about it in their interviews later on. I'm talking about the members of that of that government. We had a list of 500. We are already, you know, I'm talking about the Bakhtiar government,
yes,
not the military, which was supposed to do the coup d'etat and arrest everyone.
Right, right.
The Bakhtiar government itself, the people in that government, again, on the BBC, so the people don't think we're making up stories came on and said we had a list of 500 or 600 people.
Yes.
We already had the prison.
I saw the same program.
We had the prison ready in some far-off place. We were going to go and arrest everybody in one night and take them to that camp and decide what we're going to do with them. And, you know, and we had the list of executions and so on. And so,
they did.
So, again, this shows the man, because we're talking about his extraordinary personality.
Well, of course we are.
His reliance on God. None of this could have happened for Imam. Imam could not have had that strength and that courage if he didn't believe in God.
God, of course.
If he didn't trust God completely.
Mm.
Okay? If he did not have complete faith and belief in the promises of God as is stated in the Quran.
Sure.
If he did not have complete trust and did not take as his model the model of the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Of course.
Of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Peace be upon him. Yes.
Okay? So, this is what we're trying to say here, which is that you have this man, the way that the Supreme Leader explains it, who was the same level that he was courageous and able to come out. He also spent the nights, you know, pleading and seeking grace
from God. Yes.
He derived his strength from that personal worship and that personal servitude to God,
of course,
which then translated in his into his power,
of course,
against the enemies. This is an important lesson for Muslims.
It is very much so.
Your power doesn't come from anything but God.
God, absolutely.
And how do you tap that? You tap that by being a servant of God. Okay, we say it. It's easy to say.
It's easy to say,
but it's difficult to implement. You know, we all are. So don't, you know, talking as though we've done this, in our own lives.
I wouldn't even want to venture there.
But at least we saw somebody who did.
Who did.
And there was Imam, and he will always be an example, and he will also be Hujjat. He will be
Hujjat, yes.
For us in the next world, in the sense that, I'm talking, could be against us. Allah will say to us, look, I sent somebody, he was your example. You could have followed.
Because the Holy Quran says that there is no time, no period that the world will not be without an imam, right? So even though we are still waiting for the last savior to reappear, but, you know, this is no less...
On a lesser degree, we can say that somebody who lived in this time...
Time, yes.
Allah can say to them, look, here was a man.
Here was
He lived Islam. Mm-hmm. He was completely... It's interesting, Shahid Muhammad Baghar Sadr, famous martyr from... Najaf Hawza, Iraqi,
yes.
You know?
Yes, may God
bless him. Was one of the... I mean, he's also one of those incredible
human
beings that just come along every couple centuries.
Centuries, yes.
He said, you know, immerse yourself into Imam and his teachings the way Imam immersed himself into Islam. Okay? This is his famous saying. So, Imam was immersed in Islam.
Immersed.
And who says this? Shahid Asad says
this.
Okay? Yes. And he's saying, Shahid Asad is saying to his students and to the young people at that time and to the followers and to the... He's saying, you know, look at the way Imam immersed himself in Islam. You immerse yourself in this life and these teachings and this example of the Imam. And it's interesting, Shahid Asad, who, according to, you know, everybody who was there in Najaf at that time, basically was a mujtahid from before he reached the age of taklif. So...
Right.
You know, this is very rare.
Very rare.
It's very rare that somebody so young...
He was a genius. He was a genius.
Okay? He was certified genius.
He was.
Okay? So they asked him. By the time he was 15, 16, he was mujtahid, meaning he was a full ayatollah in terms of being able to issue fatwas.
Right.
Very difficult. And a person like him has this to say about Imam. He says, if Imam ordered me to become... a judge in some far-off village in Iran, I would do so in a heartbeat. Okay? This is a man who is a full, you know, full scholar in all branches of Islamic teachings, philosophy, fiqh, usul, you know, history, a complete scholar at a young age, a genius,
No doubt.
Because, you know, we've had that in our history. People like Ibn Sina, people Allama Hilli.
He was a genius. I mean,
you know, we've had people
His works were even acknowledged in Paris, you know, because they even foresaw the end of capitalism.
So anybody who's familiar with Shahid Muhammad Baghir Assad knows what we're talking about. And here's a man who says, if Imam ordered me, this is after the revolution, and this is one of the reasons, this is the main reason they killed him. Saddam killed him, because he did not renounce and denounce Imam and the revolution.
That's right.
Which was a major threat to Saddam, and then, of course, Saddam attacked. So, and so you have somebody like Shahid Assad, who, with this heavy scholarly weight, with this amazing, you know, talent and abilities, a real leader, he's saying to us, if Imam ordered me to become a judge in a small village or a small area in Iran, I would do it in a heartbeat. Okay? This is the level of person we're talking about. We have Maraje, we have Ayatollah Uzmas, we have...
Yes.
And these, they are all, you know, we kiss their hand, and they, are the ones that we follow when we're talking. And then you have somebody like Imam, who's just on a totally different level. He's marja, he's alim, he's faqih, he's arif, and then he's a leader. He's a leader of humanity. He's a leader of people, of societies, of the ummah. Not only does he teach it and discuss it on a scholarly level, he implements it. He lives it.
He lives it.
Okay? This is the difference. This is why we are, this is what we're so lacking in the world of Islam.
We are.
We sit around, even the good ones, we sit around, we talk a lot, we have it all figured out theoretically, but nobody takes action. It's about action. Islam is about what you do. Okay? You can have all the laws memorized. You can have the entire Quran memorized. You can know the history of the Prophet, peace be upon him, backwards. If you don't act on it, if you don't implement it in your life, it doesn't, there's no point
to it all.
Right? Yeah. This is the, as they say, muqaddama, it's the introduction to you acting on it. When a man like Imam is threatened by the most powerful
government
forces in the earth, he doesn't fold. This is what the Prophet did.
Yes.
The Prophet was being threatened by everyone around him. Mm. Quraysh, they tried to buy him off.
They threatened him.
They killed the people around him. Yeah. You know, banished him.
That's right.
They boycotted him. They imposed economic sanctions.
Sanctions on him, yes. That sounds very similar, very familiar.
The babies were dying in Shebe Abu Talib, years that they were living in the desert, before they went to Medina.
Yes.
The kids were dying because of a lack of medication. Gee, sounds familiar, right?
Yes.
And so he stood firm, the Prophet, peace be upon him. You had similar things happening to the Imams, Imam Ali alayhi salam being the prime example of this. You have, the issues that are surrounded Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the time of, you know, Muawiyah and Yazid. And so, you know, these are the ones we follow, and this is who Imam followed. The example of our leaders, of our religious leaders. Of our divine leaders.
Divine leaders, yes.
The Prophet and the Imams. Imam Khomeini lived it.
Yes.
He showed to us that it's possible to do this and to be successful and to die as a man who has complete calmness in his heart and who has maintained his dignity throughout his life. Yes. There's a famous story they talk about, and you have to imagine Iran at the time of the Shah, which is, you know, it's the king, right?
Mm.
Wherever he goes, you stand up, you bow, you kiss his hand. Yeah. You know, as we still have today in some countries.
Yes, we do, yes.
You know, you have to do the
very
little,
familiar
you have to do the little curtsy, and you have to do the whatever.
Especially if you're going to receive a knighthood. You know,
right. So, these things are imperial traditions.
Yes, of course they are.
And, you know, not very Islamic.
No.
Just, you know, putting it out there for discussion.
Sure.
So, there's a famous story about the Shah saying, I want to visit the ulama in Qom. This is maybe, you know, 15, 20 years before the... Maybe a little bit more, before the revolution.
Okay.
And in an imperial society, in a royal society, this is like the big deal. The Shah is coming to visit. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. You know, this is it. All right? So the Shah enters the room. All the ulama get up, and Imam doesn't get up. You have to imagine. This is at the peak of the Shah's power.
Yes.
He is the king. You know, you have to throw yourself at his feet.
Yes, and you're talking about Savak, one of the most ruthless
Exactly.
Yeah, secret police that was operating here in this country.
You know, people being thrown out of helicopters and disappearing in the salt.
Not far here from Qom.
Right,
you know,
disappearing
the
in the
here.
Salt lakes of, mm-hmm. of, you know, around Rome, whatever.
Qom, yeah.
So, you know, here's a man. Yeah. He comes to visit, and his visit is